Hi friends, this is Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 54. Redux, second time. Because can you believe it? I recorded two nice hours for you with the sound off entirely. I hope this is not the case this time. I've checked it and you should be seeing my screen. So it will be, of course, entirely different than the one that was just spoken before. We were reviewing the Orthodox and esoteric rulers of the fixed of the mutable cross, Jupiter and Mercury ruling Sagittarius and Pisces, and Gemini and Virgo, respectively. And then come the esoteric rulers, Pluto for Pisces, Earth for Sagittarius, the Moon hiding Vulcan and Venus. The Moon hiding Vulcan for Virgo, and then Venus. I just want to make sure that I'm not... Yes, I was about to start in the wrong place. This has been quite a day for me. Okay, anyway, we finish with... Part 3, and we've been talking about the beauty of death, and we ended part 3 of page of number Esoteric Astrology 53 with the list of 5 points related to Pluto and Jupiter. The first ray of Pluto ruling esoterically and hierarchically in Pisces, and the second ray of Jupiter ruling in an exoteric manner. It is unusual, we realize, that there are certain signs that have rulerships where esoteric planets or sacred planets are put in an orthodox or exoteric position, and where non-sacred planets are put in an esoteric or hierarchical position. Among these are two arms of the mutable cross, namely Pisces, where Jupiter, a powerful esoteric planet, a sacred planet, one of the most important in our solar system as it is most closely related to the Sun, is put in a orthodox or exoteric position, whereas Pluto, a non-sacred, though esoteric in a sense, planet, okay, it is esoteric because highly occulted in a certain sense, but it is a non-sacred planet, less sacred even than Mars, its alter ego, and it is put in a esoteric and hierarchical position. When we look at Sagittarius, we find something similar. Here is sacred Jupiter, again in the exoteric or orthodox position, ruling ordinary man on the ordinary common cross. And the Earth, which is not yet a sacred planet, is put in the esoteric position. And Mars, which is not yet a sacred planet and even less developed than the Earth, is put in a hierarchical position. We have to realize that these are great gods. The planetary logoi of the various planets may be with respect to each other non-sacred, sacred, or synthesizing, but with respect to man, they are all great deities. And so their influences, their emanations, can apply to the human being on any of the levels of his expression, whether his personality level, which is the orthodox or exoteric position, or the esoteric position, which relates to the soul, or the hierarchical position, which begins to bring in the power of the monad. So we can find interpretations for any of these deities in a way. We can find interpretations for them which can apply to any of man's areas or levels of expression. We're told in review that the first ray of will or power is focused through Pluto, the second ray of love, wisdom, is focused through Jupiter, and the interplay of these two potencies gives the following. It produces the duality of this sign, and that gives us the whole question of attachment and detachment. It brings about, well, attachment obviously is Jupiter. Jupiter is a great planet of magnetic attachment. We may think of it in some respects as a planet of magnetic liberation, where the consciousness is drawn up into a higher and more expanded sphere, but at the same time it does bring about coherence, cohesion, magnetic attraction, and in a sense attachment and bondage. This is the form's early response to the Jupiterian energy. The second thing which the combination of Pluto and Jupiter, first ray, second ray, bring about is the psychic sensitivity, the major problem of Pisces, sensitivity, vulnerability to all manner of subtle influences. Pluto does have a specific connection to the astral plane, to Hades, the underworld, as it were, and that is what the astral plane is. As a matter of fact, the astral hell, the seventh subplane of that astral plane, I think is specifically Plutonic. The sixth and seventh subplanes of the astral plane we should have nothing to do with, the Tibetan tells us, but it is possible that these subtle impressions can be received by Pisces, perhaps more than any other sign, a very mediumistic and psychic sign. Pluto is a penetrating planet. It pierces certain ring pass knots and lets in these energies. And Jupiter is magnetic and attractive and draws them all in. So the first and second ray here, the first ray of penetration, the second ray, truly the ray of psychism, producing the true psychic that the Christ was. We're told the Christ on the second ray was the true psychic, and this is the function of the second ray and thus of Jupiter. Jupiter is interesting because it is connected in an orthodox manner with two signs which are either, let's say, Sagittarius, a visionary and intuitive, or Pisces, highly impressionable. And as far as the other signs that it is connected with, we can find types of impressionability in them as well. The higher medium found in Virgo, and the one who is open to new and descending planetary ideas is found in Aquarius, where Jupiter is the esoteric ruler. Okay, so that's the second factor that the first and second ray and Pluto and Jupiter bring in. This is just a review. They cause the lure of the path together. In the first instance, the path of evolution, and later the lure of the probationary path with the consequence, the transference to the fixed cross, which is all we can intelligently comprehend, begins really in Pisces. There is that transitional moment at the end of the middle cross where we are making our transition onto the fixed cross. It's a moment of crisis. It's highly critical moment. And lure is interesting. The first and second ray combining to cause the lure of the path. We might say that the higher consciousness of the second ray calls to us, and the possible freedom of the spirit under Pluto in the first ray calls to us. Remember that Pluto is definitely connected with Shambhala. Aries, Pluto, Shambhala, and that's one of the connections of Pluto, Shambhala, and as well when you think of the final incarnation for some being taken in Pisces under very drastic conditions, this suggests a Pluto and a first ray entrance into Shambhala. So there is the lure of the path of evolution, go forth into matter. If you think about it, all of the signs of the zodiac are operative at all times, but we sometimes have zodiacs of 8, of 10, of 11, and so forth in the history of the history of the development of the zodiac. And what that says, I think, is that the spiritual potentials of certain signs are not available to humanity at all phases of man's unfoldment. No, but that some influence of the sign is available at all times. Otherwise, how could it be that the first incarnation, as we have discussed, can be taken individually in Pisces, whereas the mass incarnation is taken in Cancer. So this whole idea of go forth into matter at that very first incarnation, with Pisces considered to be the first of the signs, must mean that man is somewhat responsive to the more material, impressionable, engulfed state of Pisces, and that it is operative even when there's simply a zodiac of 8 ending with Scorpio or a zodiac of 10 ending with Capricorn. Those influences are ambient. They are transmitted to the earth. The form of man receives them, but his higher spiritual nature does not. He cannot enter into their higher spiritual significances. All we can really intelligently comprehend here is the fixed cross, the cross of the developing soul, the crucified, first the crucified and then the unfolding soul, and we're all beginning to learn about that, but not yet the cardinal cross, because we are not, as a rule, initiates of the third degree and beyond, and we cannot enter into the life of the spirit yet, so with intelligent comprehension. So that the transference to the fixed cross begins really in Pisces. Remember, Pisces can be considered, in a way, the first sign. It says it's impulsed in Aries, though it begins in Pisces. And in the clockwise wheel, Pisces can be considered the first sign, coming around, ending with Taurus and Aries, and starting again in Pisces if you're on the clockwise wheel. Or on the counterclockwise wheel, Aries is considered the first sign, and Pisces the ending sign of consummation. This question of where to begin, you know, we always begin with Aries on the counterclockwise wheel. But when we come to the clockwise wheel, we can, in a way, end with Aries and thereby call it a beginning. But in a number of the ways that the Tibetan measures the signs and gives them numbers, Pisces is considered number one, the first. And that's the only way, really, that Leo can be considered the eighth sign. It would be considered the ninth sign if Aries was operating counterclockwise. No, excuse me, Aries was operating clockwise. We began with Aries, and we'd come to Leo, would be number nine. But DK says that we must number Leo as the eighth sign as well as the fifth sign, fifth on the counterclockwise wheel, and eighth on the clockwise wheel. So that eighth position has to do with beginning with Pisces as sign number one, go forth into matter. Both of them on the clockwise wheel, Aries and Pisces, have mantrums of commencement. Let form again be sought. That is certainly the idea of initiating a new clockwise form-related cycle. And go forth into matter is how it's done. So even at the very beginning, I'm trying to say that such signs as Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius, Pisces, who are not listed in the zodiac of eight, are effective in the life of early man. So I asked you earlier, does the fixed cross end in a Pisces experience? And I think, in a way, it can. The fixed cross ends, in a way, at the fourth initiation, and that can well be undertaken in Pisces. There are a number of signs which are, conducive to departing the fourth kingdom of nature and having no more enforced association with it. And certainly Pisces, the sign of release, is that. So we're continuing with looking at rays 1 and 2 in relation to Pisces and Pluto and Jupiter in relation to Pisces, and is causing certain developments, of which we've named three. And the fourth is that this relationship precipitates the process of transmutation and eventual escape through death. Well, when we look at the three potencies coming out of Shambhala, they are purification, destruction, and organization. Ray 2 is purification, Ray 1 is destruction. So two of the Shambhalic potencies, and remember that those who end their incarnational cycle in Pisces do so in relation to Shambhala. They are destined for Shambhala. The Ray 2 purification and Ray 1 destruction under Jupiter, let's say, and under Pluto are related here to the process of transmutation and escape through death. Transmutation and purification go together. Destruction and escape through death go together. So these two, there's always the process of refinement. Refinement and purification is the second ray matter. When it comes to actually freeing the consciousness or the spirit from its involvement with the form, that's a destructive process. It's related to Pluto and Pluto in the first ray. Perhaps Pluto is among the planets that we know about at the present time, the most destructive planet. There may be byproducts of destruction that come from other planets, but Pluto is purposefully and with intent destructive. It represents the shears, the sharp shears that cuts the connection of the Sutratma with its forms. It can never destroy the Sutratma, of course. It can only temporarily lead to the ceasing of connection of the Sutratma with the forms that it has been animating. The fifth point relating to Pluto and Jupiter, or first and second ray, they unfold the significance, activity, and beauty of death and the work of the destroyer. Well, death operates in relation to the first ray, certainly, and DK speaks of the eternally lovely secret of death. Is that eternally lovely? Is it secret of death? It's something like that. Well, I won't go on a search. You can go on that search. But then Jupiter has much to do with death as well, because death is a magnetic event. The soul sounds a great word of destruction, but as well it's a word of attraction, because it attracts the immersed consciousness towards the higher realms. So some of my astrological associates who are very astute have observed charts in which Jupiter is very active at the time of death, because, as it were, it provides a great escape for the indwelling soul. When you think about escape, certainly Sagittarius goes on those long journeys away from the familiar territory. That's a kind of escape, and Pisces is most notably the elusive sign of escape, slipping out of the bondage of form. So this took us to the end of part three and the beginning of part four. Had a little bit of a false start there. And now we are on page 126, for me, the second glorious time. And I can tell by what I'm saying, you know, that what I said before was completely different, and hopefully some of the valuable points that were made before will not be consigned to their fate as a Charlie Chaplin film, one of the silent films. Read my lips, you know, it won't work. Usually at least something picks up this, at least something picks up the words, but this time nothing did. Okay, so onward. From this it will be apparent how important and powerful is this sign. Pisces, a sign of apparent weakness, is a sign of great consummatory victory leading to Shambhala. One of my scientific friends has said, have you ever tried to compress water, showing something of the strength and resistance of the element which Pisces represents? How powerful is this sign of release, consummation, final victory? Victors through clear, pure will can be related to Pisces. Through its orthodox ruler, Jupiter, that force is brought to bear which brings all things together. It's a very magnetic, attractive, coherent force, and in this case relates the two fishes, soul and personality, and binds them together into a functioning relationship. We rarely think of Jupiter as a binding force. We oftentimes think of it as an expansive, releasing, go-beyond-the-horizon type of force. But early Jupiter is extremely cohesive. It does relate to the second law of the solar system, the law of cohesion. Coherence and cohesion and binding. These are the powers of Jupiter to attract all things together and hold them together. So, you know, we often find the Jupiterian people have that kind of magnanimous, attractive, magnetic generosity which holds all the factors in any whole in the bonds of a loving relationship. There are all kinds of cohesion, you know. Some is cohesion simply through desire. We keep ourselves together on the basis of what we want. And a higher form is to hold all things together through the magnetic power of love. But anyway, this is the force that brings the two fishes together, and they are held together for the duration from individualization all the way to the fourth initiation. That's how long that bondage lasts, until the solar angel is at last free to return to the heart of the sun or the central spiritual sun, whatever its source may have been. Both are possible sources. So that's a long, millions of years, relationship based upon the power of Jupiter as a binding force. It is the activity, consequently, of the secondary force which relates soul and form and brings the two together. They have a great destiny to work out together, and it takes a long time for them to be able to do that. Really, you know, perhaps 25 million years for the average human being. The activity, consequently, of the secondary force which relates soul and form and brings the two together, and this magnetic potency is peculiarly descriptive of the activity of Pisces. Neither one of the pairs of opposites can escape from each other over the long period of a bonded human evolution. Neither NEI can escape. First, it is the soul and incarnation in bondage to the elemental instinctual forces, and later it is these very forces, the forces related to the soul of the world in its lower aspect, which come into captivity to the soul and become thereby magnetized by the soul and uplifted. From another angle and in a dual sign, this can also be seen working out in Gemini. These two signs are very related, as I have said. Usually Gemini is the mediating sign between any zodiacal pairs of opposites. You know, it's Aries, Libra, Gemini, Taurus, Scorpio, Gemini. Okay, but what happens when Gemini is concerned? It's Gemini, Sagittarius, Pisces. So Pisces is a mediating sign, and Gemini is a mediating sign, and they are both powerful secondary signs. Ultimately, I think that Pisces, a cosmic decanate, is the most powerful of all the secondary signs, but not at the present time, when Virgo is the most powerful. So from another angle, and also in a dual sign, this bringing of two together can be seen working out in Gemini. However, there are distinct differences in the way that works. There are sharp differentiations between soul and personality in Gemini. I'm remembering that DK said that the fall of Uranus in Taurus, it is exalted in Scorpio, brings a very sharp cleavage between soul and personality. Well, that kind of cleavage can also be demonstrated in the early days of Gemini, when the person involved, once the pairs of opposites do come into the range of consciousness, seems to be very much either the soul or the personality, and not either one at the same time, although they can be soul-personality in rapid oscillation. And later, the whole relationship becomes so fluid and so blended that there's a constant communication from soul to personality, from personality to soul, and there's such an interplay that it almost begins to look like the sign Pisces, a condition of such rapid interplay that it almost looks like fusion and the right kind of spiritual bondage. Okay, so from another angle and in a dual sign, this can be also seen working out in Gemini. In Pisces, there is demonstrated the captivity angle of relationship, and the two fishes are unable to escape from each other. The soul would be free, but the personality leads it astray. The personality would go its own way, but the soul has its intense magnetism and doesn't let it go very far. So in either case, the fish is caught. One fish swimming vertically, and that's the soul symbol, and the other swimming horizontal, that's the personality. Okay, there is demonstrated the captivity angle of relationship, and the two fishes are unable to escape from each other. In Gemini, there is also a definite relationship between Pollux, the elder brother, we might say, and Castor, sixfold Castor, the younger brother. In Gemini, there is also a definite relationship between the two brothers, or some prefer to say the brother and the sister, but there is no connecting band. So there is, this sense of alternation in time, and as the alternation takes place, now I'm the soul, now I'm the personality, it gives the impression of the two faces of Gemini, Janus, the two-faced god, one the soul looking towards the spirit. Well, actually, Janus is the soul, really, one aspect of it looking towards the towards the spirit, the other aspect looking towards the personality, but it does give that impression of two faces in the Gemini person, so they sometimes seem to be like sharply contrasted individuals. You wonder how people can be so different and so, in a way, disintegrated at first. But the integration comes through rapid and intelligent, loving interplay, and before long there is such a fluid relationship that the signs Gemini and Pisces can show a lot of resemblance. So there's no connecting band at first. And in that relationship is latent free choice and free determination. This is so interesting here. We're talking about the power of free will, which is so much connected with Sirius, you know. Of course, the forces of light could overcome the forces of darkness, and they could impose hierarchical order and law upon humanity, and in doing so, there would be rebellion later, nothing would really be learned, and man would not have evolved out of himself a deeper sense of correct choice. So there is a Sirian, Geminian, Venusian kind of line here, which involves free choice and free determination. The personality is free to go its own way. The soul does not compel, though it strongly suggests. And the soul can as well operate on its own plane, following its own predilections, unhampered by the personality. And yet it knows its duty, and it knows it must bring the personality into orbit, as it were, around itself, or bring it in as a kind of a sub-ray to itself as a major ray. So this whole idea of the Sirian law of freedom in relation to Gemini, and perhaps in relation to Saturn, the planet of choice, as Saturn is often related to Gemini in Dweller on the Threshold matters, perhaps there's a triangle there, and that free will really is developed in Gemini. When you think about the hierarchical relationship to humanity, there is very strong suggestion, strong evocation, strong invocation, but there is not compulsion. That's left to the Black Lodge, who's functioning under the negativity of Pluto, which can be a very compulsive, freedom-denying planetary influence. So we think about that, that the separation of the twins gives us this latent free choice and free determination, something that man really must cultivate, something that must be a terrible agony to the members of the hierarchy, as they know they could make things right, as it were. As many of us, let's say, as parents, know we could make things right, but that would be force. And the inner quality which would have to be developed in the person who was made right might not develop at all, and probably would not. In connection with a lesser duality found in every human being, so we're talking about greater dualities and lesser dualities, that of head and heart and of mind and love and of will and wisdom, the work of Jupiter is to develop these two qualities and bring them into synthetic interplay. We are speaking of Jupiter here, the orthodox ruler of Pisces. Now, the greater duality, greatest in man, at least, is spirit and matter. The secondary one is soul and personality. And a subsidiary type of duality is mind and heart, or head and heart and mind and love. I think we can see that the head sometimes represents will, but other times mind. So there is the duality of head representing mind and third ray, generically, and heart representing the second ray soul, or the soul generically on the second ray, let's put it like that. And Jupiter brings those two together, but there's also the head representing will and the spirit, and the heart representing soul. And Jupiter is also involved in relation to Gemini, as we will learn later, infusing the higher, a higher of the pairs of opposites, which would be spirit and soul. So Jupiter draws them together. Jupiter draws mind and love together. Mind does contain an aspect of the will, we know, but generally it is connected with the generic third ray, the intelligence aspect, with Mercury. It's kind of a Mercury-Venus situation, mind representing Mercury and love being represented by Venus. So Jupiter unites the head and the heart, the mind and love, and on a higher turn of the spiral, well, it doesn't have to be a higher turn of the spiral, it could be personality, will, and soul wisdom. It could be that. But there is a higher turn as well, that the will of the spirit and the wisdom of the soul can be united as well by Jupiter. Wherever Jupiter is functioning, it's a force which brings about coherence and a bonding and an interplay. I think there is that great magnetism in Jupiter which pulls the elements together and relates them so that the feeling is not one of compulsion, but the feeling of is one of joy of association. Joyful Jupiter. This is the work of Jupiter, is to develop these two qualities and bring them into synthetic interplay. It's really a great agent of fusion, and in this case we are speaking of the fusion of the third aspect of divinity and the second aspect of divinity. Although, as I said before, surprisingly, the first and the second aspects as well can be fused. And finally, you know, the old saying, Pisces takes from all the signs. Well, I do think that under generous Jupiter, Pisces gives to all the signs as well. And under Neptune, special ruler of Pisces, Pisces pervades all the signs. It's a moot point, really, you know, whether Neptune or Jupiter should be considered the highest second-ray source in our solar system. Jupiter with its second-ray soul and probably a hard-line monad, and Neptune with a soft-line soul, probably sixth-ray, and definitely a second-ray monad. So, you know, which is to be considered more related to the sun? Jupiter has a close relation to the sun. It may be the orthodox ruler, veiled orthodox ruler of Leo. Neptune has a definite veiled relationship with the sun. Sun veils Neptune esoterically, and then Uranus. So these great planets of expansion and spiritualization and cosmification, if you will, Jupiter, Neptune, and Uranus are all related to the sun and all related to Leo and to the expanding individual. The expanding from the individual to the universal, lead us from the individual to the universal, and that's done along that particular line. Eventually there has to be the complete fusion of love and mind before a world savior can manifest and function efficiently. So Jupiter is very important in producing a world savior. A world savior is certainly animated by the Buddhic force. You know, we see here, we see here that on the fourth plane, it's usually ruled by Mercury, a Buddhic planet, but Jupiter is one of the Buddhic planets. A world savior is bringing great beneficence to all whom he or she saves. And Jupiter is that great planet of abundance and beneficence. I mean, Christ, in relation to Aquarius, said, I am come to bring life more abundant. That is Jupiter in Aquarius, and it is one of the saving, salvaging functions of the Christ to bring this great life abundant of Shambhala through the generosity of Jupiter. Jupiter is not only Buddhic, but Jupiter is monadic, and a world savior, you know, is not simply an initiate of the fifth degree. It is an initiate of the sixth degree and requires that monadic contact. That monadic contact is a special high relationship with Jupiter, and Jupiter there will relate to both Pisces and to Virgo. So Jupiter is definitely involved in the kind of great giving that a world savior brings. And before a world savior can be created, he has to be functioning through the heart and through the through the monadic will, and so it's not enough to function through mind. Mind and love must be united, and that's a Venusian and Jupiterian function. And to be a true world savior, and they are really the world saviors who are on the second ray monad, the spirit aspect should be brought into it as well, remembering that the spirit is an aspect of the sun, in a way. It's that which finds its home within the sun, and the spirit aspect of man is found on the second plane, thus relating it to the second ray. So Jupiter is very much involved in world saviorship. Mind and love must be united before the world savior, motivated by love and wisdom, can function efficiently, i.e., the intelligence of mind is needed. This is preeminently, says Master E.T.K., the final result of the forces of the mutable cross. Final result, because there are initial results of the mutable cross, which are working out in the life of the ordinary human being, but this is a cross closely related to saviorship, because the savior must descend into the ordinary world of mutability and there bring the qualities of the cardinal and fixed cross. So there is this redemption theme playing through the mutable cross, and we see it very much in relation to Jupiter that is turning evil into good. It's another quality of Sanat Kumara to be able to turn evil into good, and certainly it's a quality of the solar logos. So this is fusing love and mind is done just before entering onto the fixed cross. If you think about it, the fixed cross is the cross in which we cultivate love of the soul. And mind, to handle all that mutability, constant mutation, is cultivated for the longest period of time on the mutable cross. Remember, you know, millions and millions of years. It can take a human being, let's say, 30 lives once he takes the first initiation to become a master, or 20 lives, or 10, or maybe even 7. Probably no less than 7, I would guess. And that would probably be very, very rare, but thousands and thousands of lives operate on the mutable cross, and they are lives in which the mind aspect is preeminently developed. There is some soul coming in on the mutable cross towards the closing days of the mutable cross, but preeminently it is mind. So we need love and mind for the efficient saviorship. And this is preeminently the final result of the forces of the mutable cross. As they work out the qualities released by the planets active in Pisces, Sagittarius, Virgo, and Gemini. Now, we're going to learn that these esoteric rulers of the signs of the mutable cross, we don't have to wait until we get onto the fixed cross in order to exercise these rulers. In other words, we don't have to wait till we're a disciple, a first-degree initiate, truly mentally focused and so forth, to be responsive to the esoteric rulers of the mutable cross during the transition period from the mutable cross to the fixed cross. These esoteric rulers will be active. This we will see. Later on, they will be these mutable cross planets will be involved in a magnetic call to a world savior to descend and work with these particular forces, uplifting them towards the fixed cross and towards the cardinal cross eventually. That's always what a world savior does. I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men to me. So there's that incredible magnetism. It's not just a second ray magnetism. It is also a first ray magnetism. I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me. So now we're talking about this transition. We're talking about the final result of the forces of the mutable cross, which have to be, in a way, esoteric planets. Although, you know, later, if we think about the world savior descending to help on the mutable cross, the hierarchical planets must be involved. Three of the hierarchical rulers of the mutable cross are already found in the esoteric and orthodox rulerships of the mutable cross, but Mars is the one that is not. So hierarchically on the mutable cross, we have Gemini ruled by the Earth, that's found in Sagittarius also, as the esoteric ruler. We have Jupiter hierarchically ruling Virgo, and that's found in two places on the mutable cross, in orthodox positions. And then we have Mars ruling Sagittarius, which is not found in other positions on the mutable cross. And then we have Pluto hierarchically ruling Pisces, but it's also found esoterically ruling Pisces. So as a true initiate and eventual world savior works in relation to the mutable cross, it's the hierarchical rulers which swing into activity. Okay, now these planets are orthodoxly Jupiter and Mercury, of course, and esoterically Pluto, the Earth, the Moon hiding Vulcan, and Venus. Pluto related to Pisces, Earth to Sagittarius, esoterically, the Moon hiding Vulcan, and not only Vulcan, but really Neptune as well, as we will see later, the Moon hiding Vulcan in relation to Virgo, and Venus magnetically drawing the twins together, esoterically in relation to Gemini. You know, it's a terrible thing when you when you kind of realize that you have talked for 2 hours and hopefully said some pretty good things, or useful things anyway, and then find them all missing because of a crazy fluke of not turning on the sound. So. And you know what, I have to remark on this day, which is the 16th of September, the moon is in Taurus, it's all about sound, and I learned a tough lesson here in relation to sound. Okay, well, let's see. Okay, now we move on. As you know, Pluto stands for death, or the region of death. The region of death is Hades, but Hades is really, in a sense, the astral plane. At least the ancients used to look at it that way. You know, after a battle, the dead would meet in Hades. It didn't mean they were going to hell, per se, or some terrible level of the astral plane. Even heroes would meet in Hades. It was the astral plane, and there are seven different levels, even though level number 6 and 7 are not exactly where you want to go. We're told we shouldn't be in association with them, and that the seventh sub-level of the astral plane is, as he puts it, the hell of the average Christian. Kind of an interesting statement. So as you know, Pluto stands for death, or the region of death. The Earth stands for the sphere of experience. The sphere of experience is the area where we encounter all these different energies, usually in the dense physical levels of the systemic physical plane, you know, where we have our tangibility. But we also have, in the sphere of experience, we also have the vital body, and the Earth is very much connected with etheric vitality. You find many Sagittarian people, esoterically ruled by the Earth, somehow promoting the vitality of the human unit, its etheric body. I think that's an important point. You know, the Earth as etheric, Sagittarius as prone to yoga, physical disciplines, exercise, that kind of thing, anything to promote the liveliness, the power of the form to move through space, and that is what vitality is required for. The form cannot move through space unless there is that kind of vitality, and here's the Earth ruled by the third ray, which is movement. So the sphere of experience, we can say we experience on the astral and mental level as well, but especially here is the etheric physical sphere of experience, Sagittarius being the most earthy and personality related of the three fire signs, Leo, Sol, and Aries, Monad. The moon of Vulcan stands for the glorification through purification and detachment of matter. That's a marvelous sentence. I love that sentence. It's a great hint at the esoteric meaning of Vulcan. The glorification through purification and detachment of matter. It's the glorification of matter achieved through purification and detachment. Purification is often a question of accelerated increased vibratory frequency. Vulcan is related to the law, systemic law of vibration. Vulcan puts on that kind of pressure which increases vibration. In the lunar realm, we have the reactive sort of third ray factors left over from the previous solar system and to an extent from the moon chain, and Vulcan puts pressure upon them. And in the moon, the light of matter is hidden, as we learn on page 330 in relation to Cancer. Let's see, we'll put this here, and we'll go to 333. Whoa, that's no good. I did it again. Okay, I'm going to get rid of that, and I'll start again. Yeah. So, Esoteric Astrology, and we'll go to page 330, and or 329, really, I see. And we have the type of light that Cancer displays, the light within the form. This is the diffused light of substance itself, the dark light of matter, referred to in the Secret Doctrine. It is the light awaiting the stimulation coming from the soul light. Well, brilliant soul light is coming through Vulcan. And when the spiritual will is applied with pressure to the matter of the lower forms, one of the results, besides pain, is the evocation of the brilliant, blinding light which Vulcan represents. So St. Paul had that glorification experience. It blinded him for 3 days. A further glorification is found, and higher glorification is found at the fourth degree, which is a great Vulcanian display. Purification, it's the pressure of the soul to achieve its own archetype. And the spiritual will under Vulcan directs the will, directs the will towards the personality to produce that archetypalization. And eventually we have to achieve this detachment. We're told that Vulcan is active at the fourth initiation with its first ray when a condition of extreme aloneness and detachment is experienced by the man who is literally between a rock and a hard place, Vulcan images. And the most extreme type of detachment, as far as the human family is concerned, is experienced there. But that leads to a great glorification. The soul is liberated. The soul or angel is liberated. Man is glorified. Of course, let's just say every initiation following the fourth is a type of glorification. There are probably certain ones that are more on the glorification line, and they are following that point, the fifth, the seventh, the ninth, and so forth. So the moon stands for, or Vulcan stands for glorification through purification and detachment of matter. This is the assumption of the Virgin, the upliftment of matter into heaven. That's really what we're doing. We're trying to spiritualize matter, aren't we? We're trying to lift it up into heaven, which is the higher planes. We're trying to lift the lesser lives so that they can truly evolve and are no longer trapped in a lower vibratory condition. So Vulcan, or spiritual will, which is ultimately the heart of the sun, ultimately Vulcan probably has a fourth ray and second ray monad. There is, through extreme pressure and heat and forcing and compulsion, kind of a downward push into matter of the soul, pushing down into matter. It's like the law of the pump, something rises. If there's enough pressure from heaven, there will be an uprising of matter. I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me. So, you know, it's not only the magnetism of Jupiter drawing towards the Savior, but it's the pressure that the Savior exerts upon matter itself, and matter responds by rising. Then there's Venus. Venus stands for the emergence of the love principle through directing power of the mind. Okay, well, you know, Venus is an interesting mixture of fifth-ray soul, sixth-ray, second-ray monad, maybe a second-ray personality. Fourth-ray has got to be involved somewhere. It's an interesting combination of soft line and hard line rays. It's that fifth ray soul, so important in the transference from the mystical path to the occult path, that gives the stability of Venus. Otherwise, quite a soft line planet. The love principle, though, has to be emerging intelligently. It's one thing to love, but one can love unwisely. That has to be balanced by the power of the mind. And the mind, of course, has will within it. So once we reach a certain point in our development, we cultivate love by meditating on love, by thinking about love, just like St. Paul did in his letter to the Corinthians. He somehow defined in his own fifth-ray way all the things that love was. He was much taken by the Buddhic energy. He had been, I think, passing through the third initiation. His contact with Buddha was much greater. If he was a sixth-ray soul, he was probably becoming very much a second-ray soul. And the greatest of all things for him was love, even though as a monad he was a very fifth-ray, first-ray type. So the emergence of the love principle, not just through magnetism, but by the directing power of the mind, thinking of all the reasons why something is lovable. When you have an object of your attention, you begin to appreciate it with the mind, and you see what its value is. That's another Venus word. You see what its value is, and where it could lead, and how it is related. So through this power of mental appreciation, the love principle will grow. It's not just spontaneous magnetism, it's having the illumination to see the lovableness of lovability of various objects of perception. It's intelligent love is what Venus really is. So students will find it interesting to work out the implications for themselves. Well, indeed, that is what we are attempting to do, and I do offer some thoughts about implications that occur to me, but that's only to set an example in a way for you to make the lists of implications which occur to you. Because, you know, the Tibetan has planted the seed here. He's given us something that is remarkable, but we have to take it far in the direction that our mind and intuition will lead. And everybody is responsible for doing this for himself or herself. Orthodox astrology assigns only two planets to these four signs, which in itself indicates a definite interplay. Well, that interplay is of a couple of kinds. Jupiter is usually the expanded vision and Mercury the mind. So we hope that our knowledge will lead to expanded vision and understanding. That's one of the great Jupiter virtues. You have to be a bit abstracted from things and underneath things in order to stand under them and understand. So from that type of bondage that Jupiter initially offers, there is later a type of magnetic abstraction that occurs up into the higher levels where you can stand in a detached manner and see. You know, Jupiter, of course, is one of the great seeing planets. It's related to Sagittarius, the sign of sight, and probably even at a certain point has a relationship with the Ajna Center. Yeah, one can think of that when the Ajna Center is ruled by the second ray, which it sometimes is. So there is this Jupiterian sight which evolves. So there's an interplay between Jupiter and Mercury, and that's kind of an ordinary interplay. Knowledge leads to expanded vision, but there's also a Buddhic interplay. Both of them are Buddhic planets. And Jupiter, Mercury is associated with the pure reason part of Buddhi, and Jupiter is associated with this detailed unity, this ability to see all the many factors as one in coherent relationship with each other. Not incoherent, but in coherent relationship with each other. So they have a definite type of interplay later on the path. But in the beginning, let us say that knowledge or intellect, Mercury, leads to intuition, Jupiter. That's the first. So Jupiter and its influences indicate the way of incarnation. Jupiter and its influences, you know, many things coming from the planet and rays transmitted through it and emitted from it. Jupiter and its influences indicate that the way of incarnation is the beneficent method of evolutionary unfoldment. It doesn't always seem beneficent, and seems hard, seems under karma, it seems under Saturn, seems tough, But ultimately, we are being given a chance to exercise our spiritual muscles and grow our consciousness. And Jupiter is always associated with the expansion of consciousness. And that the way of love, wisdom, says the Tibetan second ray, is the way for humanity to go. Now, eventually, humanity now, which I infer as having, let's see, humanity today, a fourth ray soul, and fifth ray personality, and later, a fourth ray personality and second ray soul. So you can see that this is in some ways a cross of humanity, certainly of the fourth kingdom, and eventually the two rays of the Orthodox mutable cross will be the second and the fourth. Jupiter will represent the second ray soul of humanity, and Mercury will represent the fourth ray personality of humanity. Right now, maybe, the fourth ray soul of humanity is Mercurian at the present time, and the fifth ray personality of humanity is not strictly Venusian. It has elements of Saturn and Mars and other concrete tendencies. Mercury indicates, so that's what, let's just say that evolution is beneficent, and for all the tough karma, there is beneficence. Mercury indicates the line of least resistance for humanity is harmony through conflict. We don't always foresee the best way of doing things, and we enter into conflict first, which eventually we have the power to harmonize. For Mercury expresses the fourth ray energy, which is Buddhic, intuitional, and expressive of the Christ, as Mercury and the Sun are one. Well, there is Mercury as Buddhic and expressive of the Christ. Well, the Buddhic plane is very expressive of the Christ, but Mercury and the Sun are one. And the Sun and the Christ are equivalent, great second-ray sources, and in a way, the Sun really begins to blaze on the Buddhic plane. We can say that from a certain point of view, the lower lower subplanes of the cosmic physical plane are very Saturnian and lunar, lower Saturn and the Moon, in a way. The Sun begins to come into prominence here on the higher mental plane, but not yet. It's not yet released, and the Sun comes into increasing prominence starting from the Buddhic plane and rising all the way up to the divine plane, which is ruled by the first of the manifest creative hierarchies, which is ruled by Leo, and hence the Sun. So the Sun is really coming into its own on the Buddhic plane. Mercury and the Sun are one. So we are a struggling creative hierarchy. We are a struggling kingdom of nature with other kingdoms in our creative hierarchy, souls and planetary lives and so forth. And we must struggle first. We tend to struggle first and then realize through interplay harmony. The realization of harmony through conflicted interplay. Let me put it like that. The realization of harmony through conflicted interplay. And that becoming smoother as time passes and as we learn. So Mercury is Buddhic indeed. Mercury stands for, let's say, five levels of the mind. You know, concrete mind, son of mind, abstract mind, transcendental or Buddhic mind, and then finally atomic mind, the mind that represents the law and the spiritual will. So Mercury expresses the fourth ray energy, which is Buddhic, intuitional, and expressive of the Christ. Think of Mercury as expressive of the Christ. How interesting. Its fourth ray aspect is, its soul ray, fourth ray, is expressive of the Christ. Actually, though, the monadic nature of Mercury is probably quite fifth ray, third ray, as I presently conceive it. You know, my opinions are possibly will change as time goes on, but at the moment, my present level of ignorance, that's what I think. The esoteric planets, and then he goes on and says, but the esoteric planets are more explicit in their inferences, and man appears when ready for their influence to be responsive in a fourfold way, which is not in the earlier stages. So that's about, I'm going to say here, the end of Esoteric Astrology 54. I did want to make these a bit longer, but having been sadly surprised by the absence of sound in a two-hour presentation I just made for you. I think I'm going to take things a little more cautiously, say esoteric astrology and 50 esoteric astrology adventure 54.2 end. And that is from page 126, I assume, to 127. Okay. And then we'll see whether we... Yeah, it's not too bad. Not too bad. Almost where I was the last time. So this is... we will now together do the great invocation, which is the... Okay, from the point of... of light within, which is the way to end these adventures. After all, it's not just about learning esoteric astrology, it's about preparing for the reappearance of the Christ and the externalization of the hierarchy, and preparing for a 2,000-year reign of hierarchy on our planet, in which esoteric astrology will be very important. So the Great Invocation is... our greatest tool for bringing about the rapid and appropriate reappearance of the Christ. From the point of light within the mind of God, let light stream forth into the minds of men, let light descend on earth. From the point of love within the heart of God, let love stream forth into the hearts of men. May Christ return to earth. From the center where the will of God is known, let purpose guide the little wills of men, the purpose which the masters know and serve. From the center which we call the race of men, let the plan of love and light work out, and may it seal the door where evil dwells. Let light and love and power restore the plan on earth. Okay, friends, so that's the end of Esoteric Astrology Adventure number 54, and we'll continue with number 55, and we hope that all works out well in terms of the sound and the picture as well. Okay.